Today is December the 6th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, who's on remote. WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and the program that is heard on PRN.FM is the regular program of the Personal Computer Show, and the broadcast on WBAI will differ in content. Podcast of the regular program is available on PRN.FM and on our website, PCRadioshow.org. The podcast of the program on WBAI is on WBAI.org/archive. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing real well, Hank. I'm a little bit disappointed that you say that the regular broadcast is not going out over the WBAI antenna.
Well, it's a different program, and it's different in content. Our regular program, as always, is on PRN.FM, and when BAI is in a membership drive, the content has to be different because it's a membership drive, and it's
they always seem to be in a membership drive.
I know. There was 5 weeks in October that went into November, then we had another week, and now we have another one, and another 3 weeks, and then we were told in January there'll be still another three. That's part of life, I guess. Hey, Joe, what I want to talk about is that, you know, we always cover the news, what's important, but I want to try something a little different to start off the show with, is that we're human beings like everyone else. We have our own problems with computers, and you had a great one. Can you tell us about it?
Sure, Hank. You were telling me about how wonderful Firefox is. There's a brand new Firefox out that's totally different from anything they've done before, and you really liked it. You said it was super fast, and I ought to try it. So I took your advice, and I went out and I downloaded it. I downloaded the Android version. I want to be clear on that. And put it on my tablet, and I was having all kinds of problems. It wasn't going to the URLs I wanted it to go to. It wasn't opening up windows I wanted it to open. I called you up, and I said, this thing isn't ready for prime time. This is a terrible application. What did you say?
I said, you probably fell into the once-in-a-blue-moon thing that Andy Grove talked about where I insisted that the dropping memory parity from hardware systems is a bad idea. He said that only happens once in a blue moon. I totally disagree. What I said to you was you had a memory parity error in transmission, no way of detecting it. And I said, just remove it and download it again.
And what upset me most of all is it wasn't my fault, and there was no way I could know what was wrong. It was only because of your expert explanation and your experience. I went in and I downloaded it when I erased it. And when I disinstall or uninstall a program, there's basically three ways you can do it. You can do it through the Windows control panel. You can do it through most programs have its own uninstaller. Or you can do it through a third-party uninstaller. And I've found traditionally, for me, the third-party uninstaller always cleans out almost everything that's on there, including what we call the little mouse droppings or mouse trails. And so I uninstalled it with uninstaller, easy uninstaller I used, and I re-downloaded it from the same site. I went to the Firefox site.
Mozilla.
Right. And I always try and download it from the developer because there's less chance of having junkware downloaded with it. And I downloaded it again from Mozilla and started putting it through its paces, and it worked. It worked the way it was supposed to work. Let me put it that way.
And what didn't you like about it?
Everything.
Oh, now, come on.
It has a different interface. Remember, I've been using Chrome for, 6 or 7 years now, Hank?
In other words, they had indoctrinated you into something.
No. No, what it was before Chrome, I was using Internet Explorer, and before that, I was using Opera and so on. What Chrome did was they refined the program to be a very logical interface that was very intuitive and easy to use without looking at any how-tos. Now, I'm not saying it was the only way to do an interface, but it was one that automatically, I intuitively knew how to use. Now, on this one, several things happened, and I spoke to you about a few of them. For example, if I was looking at a page, a regular HTML page, and there was a link in there to something I wanted to see, a hot link, I went over to it and clicked on it, and it went whir, click, click, and opened a window in the lower right saying it had downloaded the link. Now what? Well, I clicked on the link because I wanted to see it. I didn't want to download it, so I had to click on that, and then it switched a window, and then it did all these wonderful things. Fooey, I don't like that.
Well,
now, on Chrome, I was reading a page. I wanted to continue. It said, another link that was further. I clicked on the link. It quickly flipped that up. I could read it. Then I could hit a key and go back to what I was reading. I saw no, but there was a real important reason why Firefox had to change that.
Well, what you're describing is something that was started about 30 years ago by Apple, where when the IBM PC was first introduced, the documentation was so thorough. It was unbelievable. It's it came in binders and so on. And Apple said, with the Apple, it's so intuitive. You don't need a manual at all, which is not true at all.
That's true, what you're saying, but that was not the problem here with what I was facing. What I was facing was a problem that was brought to everybody's knowledge by Lotus 1-2-3. Do you remember what happened? Everybody said, Lotus 1-2-3 is a very good spreadsheet, and we'll make one that's just as good, maybe even better, and we'll use the Lotus 1-2-3 interface because that's what everybody's used to. And Lotus sued, and Lotus won. So when Firefox decided to upgrade their browser, they could not use the Chrome interface because it was owned by Chrome. So they had to change it. Now, when you change something, you can change it to be the same, to be better, or in this case, to be worse.
Well, actually, it's different, okay? And what I was referring to was that we got into the culture of saying that everything is so easy, you don't need documentation, and if you do have documentation, which is really useful, it's almost like a negative because documentation is required. And I just wish we get away from this and just be honest with the public, say,
absolutely.
Hey. Because
I used to like that. I remember my first computer, Hank, was a K Pro 2, and it came with a fully loaded disk of software, and it was the perfect writer, perfect spreadsheet, perfect something, and perfect something else. And you know what was really great was it came with three or four books, each one explaining what that piece of software was and how it worked and how you could play with it and how you could do things. And I'll tell you, I so appreciated that. Now you go out and buy the most sophisticated software there is, and that's it. You're supposed to instantly know how to use it.
Well, actually, I was at a birthday party with a mix of people, and we had older people and younger people, and what I found is that with younger people, they really don't bother with documentation because they've grown up with it. The way they were brought up in its culture,
Hank, wait a minute. You just reminded me of you and I were both beta testing a piece of software. I don't really remember the name of it, but it was in competition with DBase 2.
It was Paradox.
Was that the name of it?
Yes, it was Paradox.
At any rate,
you see how well you remember it?
It came with like a 300 or 400-page book, which I read before I put the disk into my computer, because that's the way I grew up, and that was my personal background. And when I put it up, I found very little problems. It was a very good piece of software. I enjoyed using it. And then something happened on my on another program, and I went down to your office where, at that time, you had not only your office, but you also had a large room that you had set up as a laboratory with, and you staffed it with two or three people. And it was an excellent, excellent facility for those of us who didn't have to pay for it. You gave it to us free. And while I was there solving my problem, you came in with a really bizarre problem about Paradox. I guess that was the program. I didn't remember the name. And I said, no, Hank, that's not a problem. You just do it this way. And he said, how'd you figure that out? I said, I didn't figure it out. I read the manual, didn't you? And you said, I never read the manual.
Well, you know, when you're in the field of testing, sometimes the well, first of all, there are problems with manuals. The manuals are not written initially in English, and my first language is in English. And the translation on some of the stuff is...
Well, Paradox was written in English.
No, no. The program may have been, but the documentation may not have been, okay? But be as it may, we worked ourselves through it. But the point I was trying to make is that with older people, you're trying to teach them how to use a computer, and the basics, when you don't have the manuals there, there's nothing to start off with a younger person. They don't even bother with it because they know what you're talking about because they grew up with it step by step. It's not
but
like something.
What do you do with a young kid? I won't put an age on it. It varies in every family. But a young kid, you get him his very first computer. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to walk him through it?
No, they don't need to. However, once in a while, they do get tripped up, okay? I told you about my granddaughter being tripped up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was that, you know, she's at that time, I think she was about 4 years old. And, you know, she's going through my pile of, you know, technical junk, I guess. And she picks up the princess phone. Hey, Grandpa, I put my finger in the hole. Nothing happens. Ah, you never heard of dialing. She didn't know what dialing was.
Well, this is true. You don't know how to dial. And I've told you as an equal story, my nephew who asked what radio station I was on, and I said, it's right in the center of your dial. And he said, what's a radio dial?
Hey, Joe, I want to talk about something else that came up, and it's somewhat misleading, but it's somewhat exciting, too. And that's the fact that the headline was, FDA gives nod to the Apple Watch for the EKG reader accessory.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite things, and I know it's also one of your favorite things where the headline writer doesn't read the article.
Well, let's talk about what's in the article. It's really a company that was not that's not affiliated with Apple. It's a company that wasn't paid by Apple. What they did was they designed a product that was able, as an accessory, to really anything at all that can attach to it. In this case, they just made it for the Apple Watch so that it can record EKG readings. And was it every 30 seconds they can record it and store it? And the FDA spent time going through it, and they gave approval to it.
Yeah, well, it was just more than the EKG. There were several other medical measurements that it made. The only thing that bothered me about the story, which kept saying it's so easy for you to read, for you to save, for you to look at, I get EKGs a few times a year. I get these all these other measurements a few times a year. I can't read them. They're a bunch of lines. They're silly. So if you're going to have this add-on to your Apple Watch, you better make sure that your doctor is going to be available to translate it for you.
Well, let's go through what it is, okay? The company is called Cardioband, K-A-R-D-I-A, Band, B-A-N-D. And the product is Cardioband, and it allows the users to take EKG readings every 30 seconds of the of your heart rhythm and atrial fibrillation, and records it, and then that's it. But someone has to be able to save it and do something with it. So in other words, In other words,
you need another program
to go with it, okay?
It's a wristwatch band, and the wristwatch is your Apple wristwatch.
Wait. It's more than the wristwatch band because it's connected to the Apple Watch where what you read is displayed on the face of the Apple Watch itself.
Yes. But only if you knew what it meant,
okay?
First of all, almost nobody who is not a doctor can interpret this data. There are certain data that is put to the watch, which is, highlights a danger where the rhythm does not match what the rhythm should be, and it gives you a fast warning. The EKG shows you damage that's already been done, but you can't interpret it yourself. So wisely, they've given an ability to this band to pass it to the watch, and the watch already has the ability to transmit it again as an email or an electronic message to your doctor.
But
your doctor has to be ready to get it, and he has to have the right equipment. So before you spend the $200 on this wristband, you really should talk to your doctor.
Well, it's more than that, okay? First of all, the $100 or $199 is a one-time charge, but there is also a subscription charge for processing the data, okay? And that's from AliveCor, I don't know how to pronounce it, A-L-I-V-E-C-O-R. And what it does is that it's a program called Smart Rhythm, and it takes this data, and it then sends it to the doctor,
The doctor who you first have made arrangements to send it to. Now, my doctor has a very simple request. Don't do it.
Well,
that was easy.
Well, let me put it this way. I remember going for a test early in the year, and I was at Lenox Hill Hospital, the lab, and they got the results, and I won't go into details of it. And they said, we think you should go get a second test. So I got a second test again from Lenox Hill Lab, and I got the identical results. And they said, why don't you take these and consult with another doctor affiliated with another hospital? And the other doctor I went to said, here are the results I got. Can you tell me what you make of it? He says, put that away. I'm running my own test.
That's right.
And one of the things that you'll find doctors do is you can show them anything you want. They want to run their own test.
Because depending on the validity of the machinery, the way it's hooked up, all of this affects it. Cardioband, which does cost $200, has something else, and I don't want to imply that it's totally worthless, because once a month they will drop out and to print out a hard copy of everything they've collected and send it to you or anybody else you want them to send it to. It's particularly good if you have AFib fibrillation. But nevertheless, I've read a whole PR piece from them, and I'm sorry, I'm left with a feeling that they wanted me to believe this was much more than it was.
Well, actually, I think it's a beginning of what could be very good. The only thing that I'm a little concerned about is that the product, actually, if you read the article very carefully, it could be easily adapted to a smartphone. In other words, if you think about it, you don't need the Apple Watch to have this capability
at
all.
No, but you do need something which it's able to interface with. And I have found that most things that are made specifically for the Apple Watch or even for the Macintosh won't run on anything else.
Well, let me put it this way. I think that if the developers, in this case, AliveCor, is smart, they would be able to just take this and adapt it to both the iOS and as well as the Android formats. And there's a much larger population because The Apple Watch has not taken off in a big sales boom at all, and we have a very good friend that you and I know, Joe, Robin Raskin.
Uh Yes.
And she's basically saying that, you know, what the Apple Watch needs is a real spectacular app. But this is not what you would call the app, because this app can be run on anything, but it has to be unique to the Apple Watch, and it's just not there.
I agree with you, but for a different reason. The head of CardioBand said that CardioBand paired with their smart rhythm technology will be life-changing. I don't think it will be.
Well, actually, now I know you're not going to like me what I'm going to say, Joe. I think this is a great product for people who are what I call hypochondriacs.
No, just the opposite.
Just the opposite.
A great product. I think it would be a great product. And you know, you never did know what hypochondria was, but it would be a great product.
Oh, come on.
It will be a great product for people who have arrhythmia, people who have an existing cardiorhythm problem, just to get it to check your EKG once a month. That's ridiculous. But one of the things that it does do, using its feature called Smart Rhythm, is it compares your heart rhythm to what it was to what it is now that you're exercising, and that could be very important if they develop a way of telling you that it's a problem, not reporting it later.
Well,
and that might already be here, but it's not in this press release.
Well, as you know, there's no such thing as the average person or average physical person, because our body mass is different, our ethnic background is different, and so this is, you know, just and we set these so-called medical standards, and I guess we have these standards so that when people adhere to standards, they can't be sued. I know in my case, I have an EKG at least twice a year, if not more, and my reading is not standard. I know that they always compare to a prior reading, and when they look at my prior reading, there's absolutely no change at all. I have absolutely no problem at all. But when you look at it out of context as just a standalone reading, all the fire alarm bells go off.
Well, this doesn't, in a way, this it doesn't really do that. What this does is it has the ability to monitor the user's heart rate and determine a correlation between heart activity and whatever physical activity is actually doing. And when they're out of sync, the watch does send an alert, because when they're out of sync, that's heads up for a coming on heart attack. So it's important in that way, but I like so many things I see on the horizon, they're not there after sun comes up.
Well, hey, one of the things that I do want to cover, because there's been a lot of confusion on it, and that's the Mac OS, you know, the patch, and then some people say the patch didn't work, some people say the patch worked, and then there's confusion about, is it for this version of 10.13.0, or is it what about a prior version? Is it 10.13.1? Joe, you want to comment on that?
Well, that's part of it. But Hank, I understand that after they found a solution for the root bug, and you recall that was the bug where if you didn't know the password, you just typed in the word root and you got past it.
And I used the word hastily, came up with a patch.
A little bit too hastily, because Mac OS had an update right after that, and the update undid the root patch.
Which in turn locked files.
And yes, it also locked some files. What happened there, and I feel really bad for everybody who worked on it, what happened there is what has happened to so many people so many times. You're facing a very serious problem, and there's tremendous time pressure on you to solve it.
Well, you know,
a full, complete check. You don't see some of it. Might be obvious to anybody who spent the time to do a retro check. Retro testing. It's not really anybody's fault, but it is truly defines human error.
Well, Joe, let me give you a case, all right? It's you are waiting and you are ready to have a heart transplant, and you go through all the physical tests and you go through all the preparation, and they make sure that everything is in place, everything is within the operating norm before you have the heart transplant. Okay. Now, in an auto accident, the guy's bleeding, or it could be a woman bleeding. They don't have that opportunity to run through all those tests. They have to take their, you know, best educated guess and say, what do we do first?
And yeah, exactly. Now, and you might miss something. To stop the bleeding in one area, you might miss something else that has also serious bleeding. Most people don't understand what triage is about, and you need triage on computers just as much as you need them in a hospital.
Well, I think that Apple should come up with a better public relation explanation, because they cause more confusion by having different spokespeople talking at the same time about the problem.
I'm sure that has already been fixed.
You think it's been fixed?
When you get headlines on all major media, not just business media, that different spokespeople are saying different things, as soon as that gets to the office of the chiefs, the C-level office.
No. In Apple's case, when it gets to the top cook, the top chef.
Whoever told you you had a sense of humor?
Tim Cook.
He told you that. Yeah. Okay. I'll let him get away with it.
You know, go ahead, Joe. Finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say that I felt very bad, because this was an extremely serious error that Apple had made, and they really pulled out all stops to get out a fix practically overnight. Actually, it was 2 weeks. But to have that fix kick back at you the following week, it sort of had to be disheartening for the people working on it. I felt for them.
You know what? The people working on it, I agree with you. But the way they were organized, all right, they really didn't put all their resources on it. What they did was they just put a maintenance resources on it, and because they've been focusing their development on iOS.
Hank, if you've got a team working on one thing and you've got another team available, that's the team you use. How much time would they have lost, and what mistakes would they have made if they were pulled off iOS to work on something totally alien to them? No, they did right on that. Hank, I heard a rumor. I know we don't have a lot of time tonight, but I heard a rumor that all of my HDMI cables are going the way of all of my micro USB cables.
Well, they will. It's been announced that there's a new HDMI standard, HDMI 2, to handle much higher speeds, and the speed differential is very real, and it will be released, and I don't know exactly what the physical connector is going to look like. If it looks like the same, the only thing I can tell people is that if you're preparing to install, like say in a house, if you want to be able to wire it up, pre-wire anything, go find out what those connectors are. Find out what the cabling requirements are. You don't want to be stuck where you're wiring up the place where it's no longer effective at all. You really got to make sure. It's HDMI 2.0 you have to look up.
You do have to. I want to change the subject just slightly for something we covered a couple of weeks ago. My phone has a USB connection at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I plugged in a micro USB drive, a micro USB plug, and it didn't fit, so I turned it over, because I do that all the time. Micro USB is one way is up and the other way is down, and the two don't match. And it still didn't work. So I looked at it carefully, and then I went and got the plug that came with the phone, and I saw it's the same size as a micro USB, but it's not a micro USB. First of all, it's completely symmetrical. You can't tell top from bottom.
That is not USB.
And that turned out to be USB Type-C.
Correct.
Now, Type-C was made the way the first one should have been made, non-directional, but the problem is none of the old ones will work because the old ones are micro USB, not Type-C. Now, did so much change that they had to change this? No. What they did was they went back and re-engineered the original one to the way it should be. And yes, they added a couple of wires, but they could have had those wires in the first place. I'm bringing that out now because it's very possible that your HDMI cables are going to have to be thrown out also. I went through a box yesterday, and I can't tell you how many pieces of cable or connector I have that right now won't work on. It'll still work on my tablet, but not on my smartphone, and the whole world is going to that.
Hey, Joe, I happen to have a lot of Centronics parallel cables. Do you need them?
If you would ask me,
your silence
year,
is deafening.
Yes,
huh?
I had a printer last year that still used it.
The Centronics, right? Yeah, you know what? We got. I have a lot of old cables. I seem to have. I keep two or three of them in case someone's looking for it. And,
well, I got to admit that I've recently thrown them all out. But I do remember about 5 years ago, I got a panic call from a friend of ours. Richard needed something, and I looked in that big bin, and it was an old, obsolete 10-year-old tape, and I found one. I gave it to him. He was very happy. But you get into the habit of not throwing out this technology. It's such a waste.
Well, especially when you spent quite a lot of money on it, you just sort of like, you want to close your eyes and just do it. It's very difficult. And also, on cables, that's not a problem at all. But on some of the electronics, you have to be very careful because do you just toss it away or do you have to go to the recycle center
well,
to do it?
First of all, don't toss anything away. First check. I know at least four times a year I get a thing from the city on what I can throw out and what I can't throw out. One of the worst things you can do is put stuff into these landfills that'll never, ever dissolve or get recycled or anything. You got to think about planet Earth, not just about your own selfish self.
Well, we'll do that. And, Joe, I just want to tell you that I have a lot of spare stuff in the house, and it's about time, you know, I clean it up. And one of the things that I've always said is that one of these days when I'm retired, I'm going to be fixing this or working on this. And it's something that I just now close my eyes and just say, throw
it
out.
You bite your tongue.
Yeah. You just have to do it and just move on with, do something new, and that's what I'm trying to do now, you know. And sometimes we just say after you put it together, who cares, you know. It's as you know, we have a colleague who always reminds us the important question to ask is who cares. We talk about news items. I know that with Joe and you always say to me, run that test. Does anyone know what you're talking about? Does anyone care about what you're talking about? And if they care, what are you going to do about it?
Well, they can always write into us.
Well, there's one thing I really do care about, even though I can't do anything about it, and I've been harping on this, and I know I'm not going to succeed, is the lost parody. I call it the lost parody. Is that?
Oh, Hank, that's a lost war. That was 100 years ago.
I lost to Andy Grove, and the reason why I lost was because instead of using 9 bits for a byte, one for parody, he dropped it, and that was a savings of 11% in cost. And when you look at the overall scheme of it, come on, that's nickel and dime stuff, but you know, I guess 25, 30 years ago, that was the thing to do. You save a dollar here, a dollar there. Before you know, it's $1 million. And that's how auto manufacturing got into trouble because they were cutting corners in so many places that none of it fits. Well, tell you what, let's go on and move on to something different. Tonight, we have a couple of interesting feature segments. Dr. Alfred Poor will be looking back at his predictions for 2017, and he'll give you an honest assessment of how well he predicted whether they came out or not. On the home automation front, Marty Winston will be giving a presentation on I2C standard, how you get several sensors to a single pair of wires.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider.
Wow, did you notice that it's December already? Well, I decided that it's time for me to take a quick look back at the year 2017 and see where things have gone in the whole field of digital health technology for health and medical kinds of applications. The place I want to start is someplace that a lot of prognosticators avoid like the plague. I'm going to go back and look at what I said were going to be the important topics for this year when I presented this segment back at the end of 2016. Here goes. Back in 2016, I listed five areas that I thought were going to be very important for the whole digital health industry. First of all, I said I thought security was going to be of prime importance. The whole Internet of Things hardware doesn't have security built in. There's all kinds of flaws in the operating system, and we keep hearing about hacks and problems with the data. Well, I was wrong on this one. It didn't become a major focus. The products don't seem to be a whole lot better in this regard. It's still a problem, and I just don't think the industry is making it the priority that they ought to. I think it's going to change, but it's obviously this is going to take more time. The second trend I was expecting was miniaturization. I was expecting things to get smaller. Well, that didn't happen much either. Pretty much designs look about the same as they did last year. I think part of the issue is that it just takes longer than I had given credit to for getting new components into the supply stream, getting it into designs, getting them into production, getting them out into the hands of consumers. I think it's still going to happen. I just think that it's going to take more time than I thought. And then there was a question about how are we going to charge our wearables? I was real big on energy harvesting. In fact, there's a smartwatch that's out there somewhere called the Matrix that is powered by body heat. It was an Indiegogo crowdfunding project this year. And I will confess, I actually even bought one. Don't have it yet. Still hasn't shipped. Don't know when I'm going to see it, but I'm pretty sure I won't see one until 2018. So energy harvesting is a cool idea, but again, it's taking longer to implement than I had anticipated. On the other hand, I poo-pooed the whole idea about wireless recharging, and it looks like I was pretty wrong on that. That's gathering steam, everything from hearing aids to smartphones, and it certainly is a convenient way to recharge if you don't have to plug cables in and find the cables and leave them lying around. If you can just lay the device down on a charging pad, it's a lot easier and makes a lot more sense. So I got that one pretty wrong. The fourth thing I talked about was virtual reality versus augmented reality, and I complained about how virtual reality was getting all the hype, but didn't think it was going to have the staying power and that the real growth was going to happen in augmented reality. Well, I was right and wrong on that. I think virtual reality continues to get a lot of hype and a lot of interest, and it's certainly very interesting in the whole gaming front. There's also been some very interesting projects done with cancer patients and the elderly using VR to help them in treatment and other kinds of applications. So there is some more traction than I expected for VR, but I was right about augmented reality. That still continues to grow rapidly. It's largely hidden from consumers because it's largely used in enterprise applications, all kinds of advantages for manufacturing and repair kinds of applications where technicians can refer to documents and other kinds of resources without using their hands while they're working on machinery, and also the camera and communications facilities allows them to show experts back at the home base what they're looking at, what their problems are, and accessing that live expert advice while they're actually on the job. Much more efficient, much more productive. And for many, many reasons, I continue to be bullish on AR over VR. And so I expect to see a lot more augmented reality applications going on in 2018. The final thing that I said was that the big growth in wearables and digital health kinds of things was going to be in the health and medical applications, not in fitness. And that's pretty clearly happening. Again, it's not so obvious necessarily in the consumer world, but sales of the fitness devices are growing, but not rapidly. And the real rapid growth is happening in the medical applications, wearable patches, different devices that can help treat specific diseases. I think that's, I got that one right. And I think it's going to be more right in 2018 and build as we go forward. I mean, part of the reason for this is that we're seeing the shift from consumer to corporate kinds of purchases for wearables. An insurance division of Fujitsu bought 10,000 Fitbits for their employees of one of their client companies. Zurich Life Assurance has created a partnership with Garmin and some other companies, and they are giving free fitness devices to their life insurance customers. Emory University is an example of an employer who has discounted Fitbits for their employees. So instead of buying these wearable devices in the ones and twos, they're going to be bought by the carload, by the containerful. That's the future of wearables, in my opinion, because those are the kinds of applications that are actually going to save money, put money on the bottom line for somebody. And those will be the insurance companies, the healthcare companies, and the large employers. So I think that's going to be the future of the wearable market going forward. So I guess I didn't do great for 2017, but get some of the issues right. And in a future segment, I'll give you some of my additional ideas about where I see us going in 2018.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
As most of you know by now, in dealing with our cybernetic 40-year house project, 40yearhouse.com, we have to get down to a little more of the electronics nitty-gritty than most people. This isn't just put a battery in it and stick it on the wall and have another radio mate to it. We're doing more intelligent, more advanced things with the electronics. And in so doing, I've come up across a particular standard I'll explain to you because it's important. And then I'm going to give you one very cool way in which we're deploying something by taking advantage of that standard. Do you use your eye to see? That's a pun. Eye to see, also called I squared C. It stands for interintegrated circuit. It's a two-wire protocol. Well, two wires, not counting the ground, a two-wire protocol in a multiple master, multiple slave, packet-switched, single-ended, serial computer bus. It's easier than it sounds. What we have is a standard that lets sensors get pulled by a controller to determine what their value is. And what's really cool about it is that one set of connections, those two wires plus ground, those two wires can connect all the sensors you want pretty much within the reach of the wires, which is usually between a couple of chips on a board, might be between a couple of boards, but it's not intended to go past that. I squared C is really cool for a project like ours where we have to deal with thousands of sensor readings. And the places where we have the highest sensor density, there are 30 of these places, and they're masqueraded on the ceilings of rooms. They look like a standard two-gang electrical box. But, oh, brother, what's really up there? I want to get into that. We call that place our CAP, C-A-P, and that's for ceiling awareness pod because CAP is easier to say. Our nodes, 30 of our nodes, have a CAP, and they're installed roughly center of the room near the ceiling, with a whole bunch of stuff connected on the I squared C bus. It's not the only bus we deal with, but I'm going to get into I squared C or I2C, if that's easier for you to remember, a little more easily. Now, with the I2C bus, the Raspberry Pi can pull all the sensors that are connected to those same two wires. One of those is the Panasonic GridEye, which is taking an 8x8 gridded thermal image of the room below. Trigonometry will tell you that it's dealing with roughly 2-foot by 2-foot squares, and in each case, simply taking its temperature. We use analysis at the Raspberry Pi to determine which temperatures represent background and which temperatures represent warm bodies. That gets reported every time their position or value changes back to the relational database. So we have an intelligent node gathering things and cutting down the amount of reporting that has to happen by looking for changes. If it's news, it gets reported. That's a good mantra for many of us. We also have a separate temperature and humidity sensor, also an I2C device, a barometric pressure sensor, an I2C device, an ambient light sensor, one in fact that mimics the human eye's response. Guess what? I2C. Pressure sensors in the vent registers, I2C, an optical proximity sensor up there that detects when a ceiling fan blade blocks other sensors. We have a way to nudge that blade out of the way. And then there are sensors that really are not I2C. They just give us direct pin connections. For example, on the wall, three light switches aren't really hitting the AC power line. They're just coming back as inputs to the Raspberry Pi. You tap that switch, it knows it. You hold that switch, it knows it. There's a magnetic read switch at the door. It tells us whether the door is open or closed. In the lavatory or where there are sinks, we have leak detectors to watch for water problems. And we'll probably add low paper detectors to the toilet paper rolls. And other things like an electrical outlet in use sensor for where a TV set might plug in. That same Raspberry Pi that's connected to all these sensors, so many on that I2C bus, also has actuator functions, like adjusting the curtain motors in the vent registers, and these are the EcoVent registers, controlling audio playback through a small amplified speaker right up there in that box, and also having an IR emitter so it can emit remote control infrared pulse streams, which is how we can get it to turn off the TV set, for example, if you doze off while watching. Now, that's assuming that control over the room lights and ceiling fan gets sent over another different two-wire bus. We've spoken about this before, called Dali, D-A-L-I, which is a digital lighting interface. It comes from the master control rack, so all we're having to do is send a message back to the Dali controller. I will tell you that we talk to the relational database by having these nodes log into it, and that works. But we also have direct node-to-node communications through a very simple Ethernet writing interface called MQTT, and it works a little bit like email. You have things that publish information, you have things that subscribe to information, and in the middle you've got message brokers to make sure that everything gets appropriately distributed. So if a node has a command for a lighting system, MQTT can get it there directly. When the lighting command goes out, that also gets written to the relational database so we know the status of lights without having to go and actually sense the status. Remember, every change in sensor readings, every change in actuator activations gets reported to that relational database. And that is the system's cybernetic spine. Anything on the system can ask that relational database about the status of anything or everything in the cybernetic house. Now, there are separate discipline, and we'll call it discipline-specific controllers in the master control rack that are constantly querying the immediate value of relevant readings in that relational database to determine which actions are required where, kind of a supervisory function, but with special attention to different parts of it on different controllers. So those will take a look at things like weather and determine what actions are required where. And those marching orders go out to the appropriate endpoints over MQTT, which is one example, how we get an outboard across a drawbridge controller to send out email messages reporting status changes in the house. For those of you who asked how we get all this stuff to talk to each other, well, here's hoping you're not too disappointed in getting this long and tedious answer. So here is another look at the architecture. The nodes in our system, about 100 of them, are mostly Raspberry Pi computers acting as controllers, attached to sensors and attached to actuators, and also communicating remotely to other things that control other sensors and actuators. It works by having I2C internally to simplify the wiring, so you don't need a lot of other wires or a lot of other pins to talk to most sensors. Using Dolly indirectly through a lighting system controller to control lights and ceiling fans and that kind of thing. Using MQTT, that kind of post office game that happens over Ethernet, to go directly node to node if there is no need to make a database entry of what's happening, or where it's more appropriate for the receiving node that takes action to confirm its action to the database. And with those elements, we have all of the interconnections we need to make a very self-contained, self-adjusting system. One more thing in here. We have deliberately included in the plan a couple of other controllers that simply try to see what happens when you change variables. For example, what happens if you change the threshold temperature at which something's not background but is warm body? Does that change the performance of the system? It will remember, it will optimize. The system can self-optimize. It can learn. Oh, brother. And when you program all that, you better do what I do and back up, back up, back up. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state area. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting Thursday, December the 7th at 7 p.m. at Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor, White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, December the 8th at 7 p.m. New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on December 14th, Thursday, at 7 p.m., and I've been asked to give a presentation on tips and tricks of the Personal Computer Show. The meeting will be at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, December the 26th, 7 p.m., Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting Thursday, December the 28th, 6:45 p.m., the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will be meeting Tuesday, January 2nd of the new year at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting Friday, January 5th of the new year at 8 p.m., and they have a presentation on project integration, scope, time, and cost management, and they'll be meeting at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or wbai.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.